Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder, and today the topic is women in Islam. And to discuss that with me, I have Diana Newman, and let me tell you about Diana. Diana is a Canadian. She's earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Toronto. She double majored in psychology and sociology. She earned a master's degree in apologetics with a concentration in philosophy from my alma mater, Southern Evangelical Seminary. She's traveled nationally and internationally with team, speaking on different issues such as the New Age, abortion, nobility of history, Islam, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you.
I mentioned that you travel with team. Could you tell us what team is?
Sure. TEAM stands for Tactical Evangelism and Apologetics Mission. It's the missions arm of Southern Evangelical Seminary. So it's been designed for students, alumni, and faculty to kind of take their theoretical education and knowledge out. And we go to churches, conferences, international trips as well. I've been to Italy and South Africa, just teaching on apologetics and different issues relevant to those who are going to.
Right. I'm listed as a part of TEAM. I've just never had an opportunity to actually do something yet.
Oh, well, there's so many opportunities. This year, there's a lot going on. There's another trip to South Africa this year. We're actually going to be partnering with RZIM.
Oh, Ravi Zacharias, International Ministry.
Right, right.
So one of my favorite ministries.
Yeah, awesome, awesome ministry. So there's, I definitely have to get you connected.
Definitely, definitely.
We could definitely stand to use you.
Okay. I'm willing and able. So let's get to the topic at hand.
Sure.
How did you become interested in this topic, women in Islam?
Well, I can't necessarily pick out one thing that got me interested. I think just very generally that as a result of 9/11, I think the West got more conscious of Islam as a result of that. Certainly, things started happening and our conversations started changing, I think, is what I noticed. You had the pastor in Florida, Pastor Jones, who wanted to burn the Quran, and the fallout from that. That took my notice. A lot's happening in Dearborn, Michigan, which, as you know, is heavily populated with Muslims, and their desire to bring Sharia law over here. The building of the mosque / community center at Ground Zero is something else that got Americans in particular very ignited. So all of these things, I think, got me thinking along the lines of Islam. What is Islam, and caused me to want to look into it a little bit more.
Okay. Okay, great. So why do you think this topic is even important? What made you decide to even do because I was at the National Apologetics Conference.
Right.
And I saw you actually doing this topic, right, which is when I said, okay, she's got to come on the show and do it. But what made you think about doing that particular topic?
Several things. I mean, even before I started focusing on women in Islam, because of those reasons that I stated before, I got interested in the doctrinal differences, theological differences between Islam and Christianity. But over and above that, I think one of the things that really struck me is the number of women that are converting to Islam, whether that's women here in America or in Europe. There's so many women that are converting to Islam, and that piqued my interest. Because, of course, as a result of taking different classes and things at Southern Evangelical Seminary, we're very well aware of the theological differences.
Right.
Very well aware of what the Quran and Hadith and Sunnah and these things say, which I would argue are very relevant to the topic of women. So just wanting to delve a little bit further into that outside of my theological commitments, I think it's just good to understand ideas, because ideas run things, and we shouldn't be apprehensive about discussing things like these.
I agree. Now, Christianity mm-hmm. and Islam charged with seeing women as less than equal to men.
Right.
And how do you respond when people say that to you? They say, well, you know, both religions view women as being less than men.
Right. I would agree with that. I don't necessarily think that's an incorrect assessment, but it's not just Christianity and Islam. Buddhism says some of the same things. I remember reading a dissertation one time, and the writer of the dissertation was making the argument that Buddhism entails some gender inequalities as well. So it's not just something unique to Christianity. and Islam, but even outside of a religious context, certain forms of government have been very oppressive to women as well. Certain social movements throughout history have been very oppressive to women as well. So over and above the theological relevance, I think women, as the case has been throughout history, women have not come out on top, if you will, in a lot of different ways. But certainly, when you just consider Christianity and Islam, there are very real differences between the two faiths on what they say about women, how they view women. Philosophically, what it is to be a woman is very different between both faiths. Certainly, I'm not saying that Christianity doesn't have quote-unquote difficulties that need to be addressed.
Okay.
When you consider passages like Ephesians 5 that talks about women submitting to their husbands, wives submitting to their husbands, or even 1 Corinthians 14 that talks about women being silent in the church. I do think that all of these passages have to be understood contextually, and for both faiths, they flow out of a philosophical understanding of what it means to be a woman, and that's the fundamental difference between the two.
Okay. Now, I think that sort of strikes a nerve with people in the 21st century.
Sure.
Because in the 21st century, you know, people are like, well, how dare women? How dare any society or any religion or any worldview view
right.
women as being less than, completely equal with
right.
men?
Right.
And so I know to some people, they look at that, that alone is a turnoff. Some women, I know that alone is a turnoff.
Right, just the implication that something can be damaging, I guess, to their values is a turnoff. But we shouldn't be afraid to discuss ideas. There are certain things that one has to account for in
right.
Islam when it comes to what its texts say. My argument isn't that all Muslim women are oppressed, or that Muslim women themselves don't know what it is to be valued. My argument, by and large, is that the texts of Islam don't lend to that conclusion. They're getting to that conclusion outside of the texts that are normative for their faith. And so every discussion for any religion, it relies on the texts in question. We don't judge a religion by how good its adherents are Christian or how good Muslims they are. We have to look at the text because they're normative for faith and practice.
Right. Well, you mentioned the text. You mentioned the Sunnah and the Hadith and the Quran. Well, how instrumental are they in how Muslims see women?
It depends on who you're speaking to answer that question. How relevant are they? Just very generally, I'll explain what those three texts are, the Quran and the Hadith and the Sunnah. The Quran is the revelation from Allah. So tradition says that Muhammad, while meditating in a cave, he received a visitation from the angel Gabriel, Jibril, and Jibril told Muhammad to recite. And so as tradition says, he received these types of revelations over the space of 23 years. Muhammad himself was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. And so what his followers wrote down is what constitutes the Quran. The Hadith are the commentaries. There are six main commentators of the Quran, and the two that I pay most attention to are Muslim and Bukhari, because Muslims consider those two commentators to be the most authoritative.
Right.
And so in the Hadith, you'll find stories not necessarily present in the Quran, but the Hadith kind of flesh out what maybe the Quran didn't specify as clearly as it should have. The Hadith give the meat
right.
to the bones of the Quran, if you will. And then the Sunnah are the example. Muhammad's life is an example to every Muslim today. Even though Muhammad was not sinless, he was a man, he had to ask forgiveness for sin, still Muslims consider Muhammad their prophet to be a high example. He's the exemplar Muslim. And so the Sunnah constitutes his life, what he did in his life, and Muslims consider that authoritative for their faith and practice as well. So all three, the Hadith, the Quran, and the Sunnah, are the normative texts for Islamic practice. Now, how different Muslims, the value that different Muslims accord to each of those three things is different depending on where you are in the world. Islam looks very different depending on where you are in the world. If you're in an Islamic ruled country, the type of Islam that you are submitted to is not the same type of Islam that you'll get in a democratic society such as America. So it just depends on where you are in the world, but still yet for faith and practice, all three texts are normative.
Okay. Now, what do they say about women?
What do they say about women? They say a lot of different things. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that the Quran is very contradictory, if you will. In some passages, it esteems women. In other passages, that certainly isn't the case. I think the major difference from which all other clear differences flow has to do with the creation of woman. Okay. And so, for example, in the biblical account of creation, Eve is a special creation. The Bible says that Adam was put to sleep and that God built a woman from his rib and that he brought the woman to Adam. And we know how the story goes. It says in Genesis as well that they were both given dominion authority. They were told to populate the earth, to have dominion, to rule over all of creation. Both of them, it says, are created in the image and in the likeness of God. That's Genesis 1 and 26. And so, very clearly in the biblical passage, we can see that the value of a woman has everything to do with her being a special creation made in the image and in the likeness of God. That's where her value comes from.
Right.
In biblical Christianity. Everything else flows from that. Whereas in Islam, there is no accounting of Eve, number one, being a special creation. Actually, Eve is not even named in the Quran. She's referred to as the wife of Adam. And that's the case for a lot of the female characters that you'll see in the Quran. They're always referred in reference to their relationship to a man. Of course, Maryam is named as the mother of Jesus, but that's a little bit interesting to me that the Quran doesn't necessarily name all of the main characters, if you will. But over and above that, the Quran has no special creation afforded to Eve. It has different things. In some passages, it says that both Adam and Eve were made from sperm. In some instances, they were made from another person. In other instances, they were made of the dust. So the creation account for both Adam and Eve looks very different depending on what surah that you're looking at. But what it means to be a good Muslim is it has everything to do with how well you're submitted to Allah. So a good man in Islam is one who submits to Allah well. And a good woman in Islam is someone who submits to Allah well. That's what Islam means. It means submission to Allah. So there are those two fundamental differences. On one hand, we have Eve being created in the image and the likeness of God. That's where her value comes from. On the other hand, the value of a woman is in how well she submits to the authorities that Allah has placed in her life. Number one, to him, and number two, to her husband.
Okay, I'm just going to mention a couple of things I'm familiar with in the Quran.
Okay.
A passage where Muhammad allegedly visits hell.
Okay.
And he says that most of hell was inhabited by women who refused to obey their husband.
Right. I believe that's in you're referencing a hadith that says that, is that, as you said, Muhammad did say that, number one, women are deficient in intelligence and in religion. And number two, that, hell was full of women.
Now, I see a very different picture of women in the Bible, particularly the New Testament.
Right.
Because I see women having a lot more value.
Right, right.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I think that very same observation can be made in Judaism as well. But certainly, when you consider the tomb experience, who were the first people at the tomb? They were women.
Right.
Who were the first gospel carriers? They were women. We always say women surrounding Jesus. We have the Marys that were constantly ministering to Jesus. In the early church, Paul names a plethora of women that were vital to him in the gospel, in the propagation of the gospel. We have Priscilla and Aquila, who were fundamentally important for teaching the early church the essential doctrines of the Christian faith. Muslims will say the same thing as well. They can pick out Aisha, who was the wife of Muhammad. This is the wife that he married when she was six, consummated
when she
at
was
nine, and
right.
he was 54.
Right.
So they'll pick out Aisha and other women who were fundamental to the teaching Islam to the ones who came after Muhammad, which I don't necessarily know why that's a proof for the high esteem of women, because who else would have taught the early Muslims except Aisha? Just would have been a normal and rational choice to have her be a major contributor to the Hadith, to be a major teacher in early Islam. Who else would it have been? So I'm not necessarily sure why referencing Aisha in that way necessarily entails Islam's high regard for women. That has to be proven. You just can't make a statement that that was in fact the case by virtue of the fact that she was teaching. That doesn't prove anything.
Right. And I think another thing that people lose sight of is the fact that women were valued less before Christianity than they were after.
Right.
In the Roman Empire, women were considered definitely a second-class citizen.
Right.
Women, I mean, you had to have a certain amount of, like, two women to testify to equal to testimony of one man.
Right.
All these type of things that were going on in the Roman Empire. So it was Christianity that actually elevated the role of women.
Right.
And I find it ironic that now people look at Christianity as demoting the value of women.
Right. And it's interesting that you bring that up. The high estimation, Jesus's regard for women in the New Testament, it's always tied to the salvific part of that as well. And so it's not just that there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, bond nor free. We're all together. We are all sins and we're all guilty in biblical theology. But at the very same time, we are all eligible, if you will, to be saved. Fundamentally, again, that's different in Islam. There's really not a lot of positive things that can be referred to when it comes to paradise for women, for example.
Yeah, how does that work?
That's a good question. As you know, the reward of faithful Muslim men are virgins in paradise,
right,
with whom they are able to have as much sensual pleasure as they will, uninhibited in paradise. But it's not really clear what the reward of a woman is in Islam when it comes to paradise.
Now, have you heard any, like, women try to explain that or try to come up with a reason for why that is the case?
It's interesting, and this is the thing that got me into it as well, because when you listen to the women who are converting over here, let's just call it the Western world,
okay,
including Europe. When you listen to the women who are converting, it's almost as if they are importing Judeo-Christian values into Islam. So it's almost as if they're importing value, female value, into Islam because they're coming from a Western context. Or they import democratic values into Islam, which fundamentally is not a democratic structure.
Right.
And so I think that's what's happening. All of these females are converting into Islam because, number one, they've not dealt with the problematic texts like Surah 4 and 34 or certain hadith. They haven't dealt with that. But I think over and above that, they're importing ideas from a non-Islamic context.
What are those texts that you were mentioning?
So, for example, Surah 4, which I'm sure you've heard, this is what it says, 434. Men are the protectors and maintainers of women because God has given the one more strength than the other, and because they support them from their means. And so this is Yusuf Ali's translation, and he's translated it, they're the maintainers of women because God has given the one more strength. That's what Yusuf Ali says. But that's not what it says in the Arabic. The Arabic says that God has made it that way because men excel women. That's the correct translation.
Okay.
So there's a clear dichotomy in value between man and women in Islam. There's another passage in Surah 4 as well, that's a famous wife-beating passage,
right,
which you've heard.
Well, my guests may have not have heard it, so the wife, or audience.
Right. The wife-beating passage, so to speak, is, and this is a revelation of Allah that was given to Muhammad, written down by the commentators, for any wife, and this is just a paraphrase, but for any wife that is unruly, there's recourse that a husband has. The first thing that he can do is talk to her and admonish her to line up. And if that doesn't happen, the second recourse that he has is to estrange her from his bed, no sexual relations.
That one always confused me.
Because he's suffering just as much as her.
I know, that's
right?
What I don't understand.
I don't know, this is the word
well,
of Allah.
I guess though, if he has more than one wife,
good point.
That might be an issue.
That's,
you know, like,
it.
Well, I'm going to sleep
good
with
point.
Lulu Bell tonight, and,
good point.
And you know, so.
Exactly. That's the second recourse. And then the third recourse is if admonition doesn't work, if the separation of beds, if that doesn't work, then beat them, is what the Quran says. Yusuf Ali, he translates that as beat them lightly, but that word lightly is not in the Arabic. The word beat them / hit them in Arabic is the same word that's used to refer to beating an animal.
Wow.
It's the same word. So a lot of times, again, I don't think that Muslims and Muslim women in general deal with this text in a logical fashion. Some will say that reference to beating just means a light tap with something as small as a toothbrush. Just give them a little tap to shock them. But the context doesn't lend itself to that conclusion because it's an ascending order of aggression.
Right, that's a good point.
So for the third option in that list to be the lightest just doesn't make sense. The context doesn't lend itself to that. Those are the sorts of things that Muslims have to deal with. Again, not every Muslim man is beating his wife, and not every Muslim man is taking four women as wives, which is fine, but you still have to deal with the text. And you would still have to deal with the fact that you're not necessarily in conformity with the text if you don't take the four, or if you don't take that third recourse.
Well, and that brings me to my next question, which is the idea that some Muslims would say that it is the culture that oppresses the woman, not the Quran or the writings of Islam. Mm-hmm. But I guess you just sort of pointed out an example of the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's I think that's a Western question to put up a dichotomy between culture and Islam is a Western notion. But in Islamic ruled countries, there is no dichotomy. Islam is more than a religion in the sense that it's just not a set of doctrinal tenets that Allah gave. Like, Allah tells you how often to pray. He tells you how to dress. He tells you how to eat your meals. He tells you what you're able to do in your life. It's a pure lifestyle more than it is a religion. So for someone to say that cultures have kind of diluted what pure Islam is, that doesn't make sense. Over here we have the separation of church and state, but it would be wrong to import that into Islam. Islam again means submission to Allah in every area of life. You'll hear this from the fundamental Muslims as well. That's the basis of Sharia law. I mean, Sharia law are public laws, sanctioned laws that are based on the Quranic text, based on Hadith and based on Quran. So this idea that there can be some type of separation is not a proper understanding of what Islam is.
Now, how would you respond to someone who just says, you know, you're a Christian, so you're obviously biased against Islam?
Well, the first, I don't like the word biased.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Because I think when people say that, what they really mean is that because I have my own thoughts on the matter, then it's impossible for me to be objective. That's just not true. Every one of us, there's no neutrality. Every one of us has a preconceived notion about something. As soon as the mind starts to think about something, we start forming opinions and we start asking questions. So this idea that I bring bias to the table whereby I can't be objective in it is, I think, is just a false way of looking at it. For the person who would say that I'm biased, I'd be able to turn around and say that you're biased as well, because you're biased to the fact that you think I'm biased.
Right.
So that's really not a good way of framing it. The real issue is what preconceived notion, if you will, or what bias, if you will, is accurate, what's true and what's false. But everyone has a bias. That's the purpose of discussion and truth finding.
If you came across a woman who was a Christian who was considering converting to Islam, what would you say to her?
Well, depending on where she is, that question really, over in Islamic ruled countries, that question is sort of meaningless, because if a man or a woman wanted to leave Islam and come to Christianity, the punishment for that is death. So I guess that question would really apply to Westerners over here. I would really say some of the things that I've said tonight is, have you dealt with this passage in the Quran? What do you think about that? Have you dealt with what Muhammad said in the Hadith? Have you dealt with that? Do you understand and know what Islam means? Do you know that you're not made in the image of God in Islam to the degree that you submit well to Allah? That's where your value comes from. Again, I don't think enough attention is being paid to the text. I think that we're looking at individual people. I think that we're, again, importing certain things into the religion called Islam, and not enough attention is actually paid to what, at the end of the day, is the most important thing.
Okay, well, Diana Newman, we've come to the end of the show.
Already, that was fast.
I told you it was going to be fast.
You did.
And I'd like to thank you again for being on the show, talking with me about women in Islam.
You're welcome.
And that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes, by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org. For the hope that lies in you.